This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run begins. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of interviews, views, and analysis. I'm very excited because it is Friday, and you know that's a reason for all of us who work a five-day week get excited because it's come to the end of the work week.
And I share in your excitement, my friend.
Okay, and do you have plans for the weekend?
Just the usual. It's going to be a time of catching up with friends, family, the usual.
Oh, right. Okay. So,
and yourself?
I don't know. I might sleep. I think that would be a really interesting
proposition. Look at you, living life on the edge.
I know. Television, you know, maybe a protest or two.
Yeah,
who knows? I mean, it really depends on how the weekend unfolds. Mm. And it's looking like it will unfold in interesting and dramatic ways. Mm-hmm. Now, the world didn't stop as we slept. It went on spinning. And that some news from that and stories that come from the end of yesterday's news day. One, which includes, is of research that shows that rising global emissions of chlorine-contained chemicals could slow the progress made in healing the ozone layer. So that's not really good for the fight to save the planet and our own lives.
Now, also in world and Malaysian news, you've got the foreign ministry here in Malaysia now wants to shut down the Malaysian embassy in Pyongyang. Yeah. So obviously, this is the latest development in Malaysia's ongoing spat with North Korea. I think recall back in March, Pyongyang expelled Malaysian ambassador Mohammad Nizam Mohammad in retaliation to Malaysia expelling North Korea's ambassador Kang Chol.
Okay, speaking of international diplomacy, Israel will join the U.S. in pulling out of the U.N.'s cultural organization UNESCO after U.S. officials cited anti-Israeli bias. Israeli Prime Minister praised the U.S. decision as brave and moral. Mm. I'm quoting that.
Brave and moral. I wonder if that would best describe this next warning here. So apparently the police has warned the Red Shirts leader, Jamal Yunus, against illegal acts ahead of Saturday's anti-kleptocracy rally. Perhaps that was what you were alluding to earlier, Sharad, maybe?
Yes, yes.
Oh, okay. Jamal Yunus had apparently said he will set up a stall to sell cheap fish over there. Ikan kembung, I've been told.
Yeah. So the anti-kleptocracy rally, of course, is being organized by Pakatan Harapan. Education Minister has urged the remaining 60,000 teachers to register who haven't done so for the next general elections. I thought it was a very interesting a bit of information from the minister itself, knowing that they're actually tracking whether teachers have registered
and,
or not.
And what roles? Registered as voters? Or?
Yes, registered as voters. Interesting. So we're obviously deep into election season and hasn't been announced, and there's a lot of speculation as to when and if and how. And there's no ifs, because if we're to remain a democracy, an election will have to be held by August of next year.
Mm. And speaking about democracy, I think coming up in just a bit, we'll consider this idea whether or not there's such a thing as too much democracy.
Oh, interesting one. Mm. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Sister Golden Hair by America. I'm Sharad Kutan. And with me, Tan Chung Han. We just talked about how America, the United States of America, to be more precise, has decided to pull out of UNESCO. Now, so what is this great democracy, a shining example on the hill for all around the world?
I sense a tinge of sarcasm there.
Yeah, well, okay, so democracy has produced Donald Trump. Needless to say, democracy now as a concept is deeply tainted.
What?
Well, and we're going to tweet out an op-ed by Robert Talisi. And who talks about the question of democracy, what it means, and whether we can have too much of it.
Right. So Robert Talisi is a professor of philosophy and the chair of the philosophy department at Vanderbilt University over there in the state of Tennessee. So essentially he talks about whether or not democracy should be tempered in today's context. And it's not a case of, say, having some kind of authoritarian dictator-like figure clamping down on free speech. No, but it's the idea of perhaps people, you know, agents in within a democracy, you know, being able to put politics into its own place, whereby you create these pockets of social interaction that is free of politics. I mean, I would like to think so. So first thing that comes to mind would be like, say, sports or music, you know, etc. You know, given the kind of, I don't know, the political undertones that seems to creep into every aspect of our lives, there's this rising, you know, fear of political fatigue, right? So perhaps this discussion is rather timely.
Well, you know, just on a kind of completely off-tangent okay. note, the Vanderbilt name is an interesting one in the context of America. And, I mean, the most prominent, I think, Vanderbilt today is Anderson Cooper, right? Whose mother is Gloria Vanderbilt, and who's 93, I believe, just looking at the wiki. But also harkens to the fact that, you know, in the early part of America's history, there were all these robber barons. There were all these very autocratic, undemocratic individuals who then went on to endow institutions we associate with liberal democracies, right? So liberal democracy is really the form of the political systems that we sometimes just use, we describe as democracies. And that's a shorthand because the liberal part of the liberal democratic concept is actually very important.
Yeah, so going back, well, just because he works for Vanderbilt doesn't negate what Thales is trying to...
This is precisely the point.
So going back
the
to...
The basis of it, so the foundations might be murky and might be quite different from what comes out of it. And, and that's, I think, an interesting irony. And in fact, the deep paradox of many of our institutions.
Yeah. So, I mean, going back to this article here and what the professor suggests here, you know, and he uses this phrase or this sentence, keeping democracy in its place. You know? So, do you think, you know, Sharad, I mean, we as a society, we are nuanced enough, we have the kind of context to say, okay, this is politics and we can draw this hard and fast line and then we can have our fun?
Well, you know, I think the question is what we mean by politics, because in some sense, everything is political.
Right.
In the sense that, you know, power relations and power dynamics are involved in everything, in families and such. So we don't often think of families as a place for democracy, but one can use a democratic framework to look critically at the way in which family dynamics operate. So I'm not for one to say, well, you know, families ought to be democratic, but one can use that to unearth troubling dynamics in a family, right, where somebody might have more voice than the other. So, if, you know, typically in a traditional family, perhaps the father has more voice, not from than his children, but then that his wife has. So the dynamics between mother and father, between husband and wife, might be where you want to look at that whole democratic issue or power relations issue.
But then where do you draw the line between just, say, good old social roles and social functions versus politics, though? When does, I mean, because based on the situation that you described, right? Because, you know, this would be a debate or discussion about, say, a patriarchal society and the imbalance of power there, right?
Yeah, and so, you know,
when does it tip over into, say, I'm using air quotes here, politics? You
know? Well, it tips, it in fact, in the first instance, is political because the father would will say, well, you know, this holy text justifies my dominance. You know, God and the divine plan justifies dominance, or we've always done it this way to justify his dominance. And in citing that, whether audibly or not, he's already introducing politics into the game, because that's an ideological position. That's not a natural one. And so I think that the whole democratic question, as much as we want to keep maybe party politics out of all things, it's very different from keeping democracy out of all things.
Well, you know, so again, the idea here that is being espoused by the professor is that democratic politics has thoroughly infiltrated our social lives. Just bringing it back to the Malaysian context here, say, when it comes to anointing the head of the Football Association of Malaysia, that is a very politically charged process, you know, or even how our schools are run, you know, politics. politics infiltrates that as well, right?
Yeah, so process is, I think, the key word here, because you could see democracy not as a value system, but as a methodology. You could see democracy as a process of electing people, and to the extent you have to, right? And so how else do we do it? Well, we've done it very different ways, right? We can people can be anointed. Where we have, and this is a question that a lot of Malaysians are asking when it comes to local government. Now, local government leaders and mayors in many cities in the Klang Valley are anointed. They're not elected. Has that made for better governance? Will electing them make for better governance? Big questions.
So perhaps with democracy being a process, is it amoral in itself with the results? That, because like you mentioned earlier,
absolutely.
Right, Donald Trump, right? So these are the results of an amoral process.
And he had many less votes than Hillary Clinton. He still won. Well, because, well, that's a different thing, because that we get into the system of elections there. But okay, very interesting discussion. If you have an opinion on whether you can have too much democracy, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Join us in this conversation all morning and all day, in fact. Stay tuned for more BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Somebody's Baby by Jackson Browne. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han, and I've just tweeted out from my personal Twitter, not from, you know, the organization's Twitter, a big image of Han right now. So if you want to, you can always follow me at Sharad Kutin.
I see what you did there.
Personal plug there.
Oh, God.
Okay. I want to mention,
I should get a commission for that, though. I
don't know how this would work, because I don't get any money from Twitter. Very quick historical note. When Malaysia and Singapore decided to go their own way, or rather Singapore decided to leave the Malaysian Federation, Lee Kuan Yew came on television. He shed tears. And then, and this is much forgotten, he disappeared from public view for about 2 weeks. Now, what was he doing? Well, all accounts suggest that he was wallowing in depression or self-pity or anger or whatever, but he was wallowing. Now, some people might say that's very undignified. And in fact, you know, any number of uncles and aunties would probably have told you when you were in a fit of depression and wallowing not to do so, that, you know, jump back up on that horse and keep riding or whatever, you know, a home truths that are spun by, you know, the people who are older and wiser than us. But some research suggests that it's actually good to wallow.
Yeah, you know, so we've got this article from mailmagazine.com essentially saying that it's okay to turn on those sappy Elton John songs, or even the one that we just heard just now. I think that would be a song that is
Somebody's
Baby, you know, just to, you know, appease the demons inside and say, you know what, somebody loves you out there. And
I remember Jackson Browne from the 80s when I was at university, and the fact that he kind of took up the cause of the Sandinistas, and that was all that conflict out in Central America and Nicaragua.
So it is an instinct anyways, right? Like when you are feeling threatened by the world, or your place in the world has been undermined, it is an instinct to withdraw, right? And to find yourself in isolation, at least to kind of cut off any other stimulus that might further threaten your already vulnerable state, right?
Yeah, and I think that's very legitimate, right? So the idea is that if you've been destabilized by some sort of trauma, some sort of crisis, how do you get yourself back on your feet? And is deep contemplation the way to do it? So, you know, we have a very legitimized ways of you know, retreating. And you think of religious institutions that where, you know, and monastic orders, for instance.
Or even just plain old meditation.
And, you know, people, I know it's become very popular to go on these Vipassana, you know, retreats where people sit in silence for, you know, 10 days. They pay good money to sit and be silent because, in fact, in most of our lives, to do that would be extraordinarily difficult. So you have to kind of go somewhere to do that.
Yeah, in fact, so it is a growing trend now. There's this guy by the name of DJ Cliff Gloom, a.k.a. Carl Hill. He's the founder of Feeling Gloomy. So it's a club night where it caters to those who are feeling despondent or who are wallowing and going through that mourning process. And they actually have these rather downcast dance parties over their New York, London, as well as other cities. And apparently it's a growing movement that's, been kind of mushrooming all over the place for the past decade, at least according to this article here.
So, and, you know, you have a lot of popular music that, you know, kind of like pushes that button. I think of the Smiths in the 80s. I'm going to quote the 80s and my youth over and over again. But the Smiths were very popular. Mm. And a lot of the songs are kind of like depressing, wallowing and, you know, self-pitying or whatever. And, you know, we used to jokingly call it homosexual death rock because it had that kind of quality about it. And, you know, But this was not necessarily bad. It wasn't a bad thing. It was just the thing.
Yeah. Well, to provide a more contemporary reference, I think of Adele's song, you know, Hello from the Outside.
Adele? You're comparing Adele to Morrissey?
No, I'm just trying to make it more contemporary, okay? Like, it's not everything about
good
the
try,
80s.
Good try, good try. I know, because what are your choices?
Dude, it's 2017.
Spears,
oh, my gosh.
Justin Bieber. What else do you have?
Anyways.
That song about the lady bumps?
Oh, my gosh. Anyways, the point being, there is a time and place for wallowing, and I think we should be respectful and mindful of that, as opposed to just telling people, hey, just snap out of it, you know, buck up, wipe the tear away, and just move
so
on.
So the question is, when does it become pathological, and when is it actually healthy? And what is the fine line between those two states, right? So you might be, from the outside perspective, doing the same thing, but actually, one could be damaging you in the long run, and one actually could help you recover.
I mean, I'm no expert, but I would think it's the period by which you engage in this process, right? Because on one hand, I would think that it's healthy to catharsize these kind of emotions and partake in this wallowing process. But hey, after a while, you know, perhaps it'll be best. I don't know. Perhaps experts, if you are an expert right now, you know, by all means, send in a WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. But I would think that a prolonged process of wallowing that cannot appear to be healthy. I don't think.
Well, one person who exemplifies that, the late and great Amy Winehouse, and this is Valerie, taking us all the way up to the first bulletin of the morning. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Next Time Around by Little Joy. I'm Sherrod Kutin and Tan Chung Han. A little joy.
Oh, and a little
less joy.
Hey, I have plenty of joy. A little twang there from you with that song title, Time.
Time. Time. Was it time for joy? Mm. Was it the next time around?
Yeah,
because it's little joy. You know, you gotta say it with a southern accent.
Everyone gets southern when you're happy.
I have no idea where little joy is from, honestly. But there is a bit of a Jimmy Carter in me, and I can pull out a Georgian peanut farmer accent if I want to.
Nice.
Okay. And it goes back to my days on the stage. Well, okay, no, I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop right now. Okay, so we had a WhatsApp message, and we don't have a name, but thank you very much. One can wallow with genuine reflection and intention to understand what happened. I'm against wallowing passively and letting emotions take over, says the person who sent us a WhatsApp. And thank you so much. Why not include your name when you send us these WhatsApps so we can identify you when you read the wonderful statement there. We were talking earlier about the value of wallowing against maybe what is traditionally seen as a detrimental practice. Now, you know, very quickly onto the next topic, which has to do with WhatsApp.
Right. So from wallowing to WhatsApp. So there's a story here about how although WhatsApp has certainly revolutionized the way we communicate, not just in everyday life, but certainly when it comes to the workplace, whether or not the benefits outweigh the pitfalls. Because, with WhatsApp groups, they could lead to the bullying, exclusion, or the overloading of employees. So how do we start defining what's appropriate or inappropriate WhatsApp usage within the work context?
Now, actually, real research has been devoted to this.
Nice.
And they looked at different sort of milieus to understand how technology like this can change relationships. One study looked at emergency surgical teams. Another looked at teachers and students on WhatsApp. And both in those two, I think, studies, the benefits were very clear, in the first instance, junior trainees could access experienced clinicians, whereas in the case of the teacher-student thing, it enhanced relationships.
So it blurs the hierarchy that is usually evident in the workplace. But then the question here is, you know, are the boundaries important to begin with? You know, be- because if, let's say, you've got a boss, you know, and because of the position of this person, they are tasked with delegating these, responsibilities, right? Then when do you have a cutoff point? Because WhatsApp is so accessible, I dare say many of you listening right now, you will probably have found yourself in a situation where somebody has delegated a task to you at like the wee hours of the morning, and it all of a sudden demands your immediate attention. And if you don't respond to it because you've seen the blue ticks, right, then it just disrupts what you're doing. So yeah, should those boundaries be in place to begin with?
Yeah, you know, there's this whole phenomenon of being away from your phone and coming back and seeing 74 messages in a single thread and trying to make sense of it. Because often, and this is one of the problems with WhatsApp, does it flatten relationships and hierarchies, but it also makes a single, what could be multiple conversations into a single thread, and it's unidirectional, right? So you don't, but you can of course quote what you said in the past in order to take a thread, but it's very difficult. You're having multiple conversations; it can be very confusing. And I think, in fact, what sometimes bad decisions are made because there's a lack of clarification as to which conversation is being quoted at any one point.
And that's why people then spawn off sub WhatsApp groups. So you've got, say, one general WhatsApp group for your entire department, and then the separate teams will have their own WhatsApp groups, and then members of the team will then have a separate WhatsApp group without the boss, so they can, you know, backstab or something. Yeah.
You know,
gossip.
If you are on a WhatsApp group, tell us, if you switch off or mute your WhatsApp work group, whatever thingies, when you go on holiday. And I think that's very telling. So you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio and tell us, do you turn your work WhatsApp groups off or mute them when you go on holiday?
And also, you know, I'll be interested to find out, like, Sharad, how many WhatsApp groups are you a part of? I'm just going to put you on the spot here.
Yeah, I think at least half a dozen, maybe a dozen actually, because they're family WhatsApp groups, and then they're the events WhatsApp groups, and then they're the, let's meet up for movie night, you know, and those kinds of things. So they proliferate. They've just become very easy to do.
You know, I was approaching double digits as well, and I had to consciously just say, you know what, guys, if you want to message me, you message me personally. And like, I had to exit a handful of groups as well. I mean, gets overwhelming, though.
Yeah, residence groups. Can think of that. Okay, we'll be back with more after this. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Never Can Say Goodbye by the Jackson 5. Tan Chung Han and myself, Sharad Kutin. The morning run continues. It's coming up to 50 minutes past 6 in the morning. It's because Friday the 13th. Okay. Fahmy and Mag, thank you very much for your messages. Fahmy says, I mute the group even when I'm not on holiday. Well, that's a bit much. And Mag says, I'm not part of any WhatsApp work group. I have 4 personal groups on mute. Well, interesting how people deal with the overload problem, I think, when it comes to the new technology.
Just shut it off. Like, just mute. Yeah.
Okay. What you can't mute is the very interesting voice of Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister of Canada. He's written an article recently for Marie Claire magazine, I think devoted to women, women's issues, but much more than that, saying, boys, and I quote here, have the power and the responsibility to change our culture of sexism. In it, the Prime Minister argues that teaching boys to be feminists gives them a sense of justice and empathy and helps them, and I quote again, escape the pressures to be a particular kind of masculine that is damaging to men and those around them. Hmm. Now, Han, what we did was we sought out Associate Professor of Gender Studies Sharon Bong from Monash University, Malaysia, and asked her if attitudes and perceptions towards feminism have progressed enough for this type of parenting to be considered here in Malaysia.
Yes, without hesitation. I'm child-free, but I'm saying that a resounding yes for two reasons. Number one, I'm thinking of my immediate colleagues and others who are feminists in the local women's movement, thinking of them and how they are parenting. And the second reason for the resounding yes are my own students from gender studies. So in relation to these two reasons, I'm, you know, interacting with living examples of young people, in the case of my students, and also fairly young parents who are very conscious about issues of gender bias and gender equality and, of course, feminism, and are in a very purposeful way raising their sons and daughters to take these values up. And all of these are Malaysians, and so very much so in an Asian context. So I'm very hopeful and very optimistic because I'm looking at living examples.
Now, of course, you know, feminism as a movement, feminism as a way of thinking or worldview is deeply contested. There's been a lot of pushback against the feminist movement since its inception, the 60s and 70s. The question is, are there a lot of misconceptions, especially those perpetrated by detractors of feminism? We asked Sharon how these misconceptions may be corrected.
The first action by men and women and girls and boys would be to break down or to dispel this myth that feminism is a dirty word. And I guess when people think that way or believe that, they do so because they blame feminism as the cause of breakup of families, because there's an uprising by women and daughters in standing up for their rights and so on and so forth. Feminism challenges very gender stereotype roles, relationships that are, you know, founded on very sexist thinking, perhaps, and certainly many of these relationships may involve violence. These are consequences that affect not just women and girls, but also men and boys. So it's the realization that everybody is responsible in undoing or, you know, dispelling this myth. And it goes a long way if many, many people can begin to see how standing up for women's rights, for gender rights, you know, which includes men's rights, is not going to be damaging to the individual or to the family or even to the community, but it's actually going to be beneficial because there is a lot of healing that can come out from that sort of mindset change.
That was Sharon Bong, Associate Professor of Gender Studies at Monash University, Malaysia, speaking about feminism.
And I totally agree with the comments from that Associate Professor. However, you know, while she draws upon those around her, saying that, you know, the Malaysian context is ready, I think we are not quite there yet. And I draw upon some empirical evidence. I've got this couple, good friend of mine, young, right? Young, got two young boys. They actually insist that they're two boys will not wear anything pink. Even purple is a grey area. So you still have these kind of instances, you know, these parents, and I guess they are right to do so, right?
But so the question, okay, so that's, yeah. You know,
and,
you
can, and
you,
for you, the record, I am totally for, you know,
yeah. Wearing pink may be unimportant at the end of the day. What's important is the boys grow up thinking that women are equals in all respects, if they equal pay for, you know, equal work and all those things that are actually much more important to the lives of women on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, right? I think it's going back to Trudeau's comments here about, you know, breaking out of this really macho mold of masculinity. Hey, a lot of M's right there, macho mold of masculinity.
Yeah, and I like the fact that you, you know, approve of your own alliterative capacities.
Because no one else will do so.
Oh, so sad. Okay, Counting Crows, Accidentally in Love, taking us all the way up to 7 o'clock, and then we'll have the bulletin. We'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm sure I'd Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han, and it's just 6 minutes after 7 on the 13th of October. It's a Friday. Yes, Friday the 13th. Doesn't need to mean anything to anybody, but I'm just saying it's Friday the 13th.
No comments, yeah.
Okay. Now, we were talking earlier, Han, about WhatsApp and technologies and affect our lives. And stuff, and we're still getting comments. And nice. Leanne wrote in and she said, I mute everything. And she says, it's like having a long leash tethering my life, right? So the idea that, you know, work has moved into the digital space and that's just like, you know, like everywhere, basically.
Yeah. And we got those messages via WhatsApp, ironically.
Yeah, we did. Because that's the only way to go. You can't fight it. There is no resistance. Resistance is not possible.
And for the record, we love those WhatsApp messages, so keep them coming.
Okay. Malaysia is now the third country in the Asia-Pacific region to launch the Infringing Website List, so IWL initiative, in efforts to combat digital piracy accuracy of copyrighted content such as music, film, software, broadcasts, and books. The IWL program involves identifying a list of the most popular pirate websites in Malaysia, sharing the list with advertisers, removing any advertisements found to be placed on those websites. To get more insights into this matter, we spoke to intellectual property lawyer Bahari Yao and asked him if this infringing website list, or IWL, is effective in deterring pirate websites.
So in my mind, it will be a right move towards combating the digital piracies. So one way of doing this is to have all this pirated website listed. And in fact, for this initiative, I would just add, you know, it is an initiative which we follow the UK operations creative steps. And while we don't know how effective, but the statistics shows when the UK operation creative set up this, the police intellectual property crime unit, there were about 75% decrease in the mainstream advertisements appearing on this pirate website. You know, one way to curb all the revenues into the hands of the illegal activities is by cutting off their revenues. And this way, I think it will be effective.
Now, we also asked him if these companies know they're advertising on illegal websites.
They don't. Okay, essentially, it's a free market. So what's happened is that then people will... Okay, let's say, for instance, today you have a product and you want to advertise. There are a few avenues for you to advertise. You can go to the newspaper. A newspaper, there are so many different newspapers. You can choose to advertise in NST. You can choose to advertise in The Star. Or you can go to BFM to have your advertisement placed on air. So these are all various platforms. So likewise, in the domain world, in this digital world, there are so many available platforms. Nowadays, everybody goes online.
Now, you know, it's worth noting that pirate websites are very robust. They're torn down one day and they pop up the next with perhaps a slightly different name. We asked Bahari what it will take for this list to actually work.
Well, like all policies, like all launches, the launches will be effective if we are proactive in it. So, for example, you come up the list. Of course, this list, if it's going to stay idle for the next 1 year or so, in fact, if it is going to stay idle for a period of 1-2 months, then of course, over years, the main one will be taken off, but there will be new one coming in. So you are absolutely right that ultimately for this to work, the stakeholders will need to be proactive.
That was intellectual property lawyer Bahari Yao speaking about this initiative, the Infringing Website List, or IWL.
All right, and I'll take his comments one step further. Right now, he said in order for this to work, the stakeholders must be proactive. I will say that in order for this to work, it must be people, Malaysians, who actually want this, because if there's no demand, there wouldn't be that kind of supply. So I swear, Malaysians know. I mean, and I'm speaking really broadly.
Are you about
here.
To swear? You can't swear now. You know that.
I'm not swearing. No, I'm saying Malaysians, we are quite creative, you know, whereby, you know, finding these various mechanisms to get that pirated content for free. I mean, we have this you know, seemingly unlimited creativity when it comes to getting that stuff. So I
think
wonder...
it's a universal thing. I mean, there are two issues here. One is that creativity, the impulse behind that, the imperative behind that is censorship, right? So people want to get around censorship. Well, they want their materials uncensored and they want to get things that, you know, that are banned, whatever it is.
Yeah, that's one impulse. Half, yeah.
The other half is, and this is the, you know, this is the thing that we all will have to maybe raise our hands and say that we're guilty of. We want things cheap.
Or free.
And there lies the rub, because the content creators, you know, cannot be denied their due, right? Mm. And, you know, we want this great stuff. Somebody's got to pay for it. Mm. And you might say, well, I don't care about others who are pirated. I want to pirate it. Somebody obviously is going to pay and these things will continue. But in fact, the truth of the matter is that you're really robbing the industry of, you know, its resources to continue to thrive. thrive and grow if you indulge in this kind of activity.
Yeah, go ahead and tell that to the average college kid who's, you know, scrapping by.
And so this is it, right? So when you think, I'm poor, I'm not, you know, they can afford it. After all, we see all these big stars, they have a gazillion dollars, mm-hmm. you know, they won't be hurt by what we're doing. But it's really not about hurting the individuals, especially the success stories. It's about the ecosystem, isn't it?
I mean, for the record, as a media professional, of course, you know, I'm against piracy. But at the same time, those ideals that you mentioned there, Sharad, it's not very palatable to the average person out there. Because if you have that avenue that is so accessible and it's so, it permeates basically everything that you do and you can get it for free, then, you know, it's not exactly a storyline or a narrative that is appealing to them now, is it?
Yeah. I mean, in the past, you know, one of the arguments against the pirated things is to say, well, you'll get the good quality stuff if you pay for it, right? So pay a little extra, you'll get good quality if you buy pirated stuff. You remember those anti-piracy campaigns that included you're going to buy something and it's for some sort of itinerant, you know, vendor, and then you go back, you've spent the $10 or 10 ringgit, you go back and then you pop it into the DVD machine and it doesn't work, or it's scratchy. Or
talk about DVDs now.
Yeah, okay. You remember the days when when pirated DVDs were huge, and Malaysia was actually a huge center for pirating DVDs, not just locally, but for, it seemed, some part of the world.
But at the same time, you know, these media companies, you know, their success is also very much reliant on the masses, right? So, you know, you have seen other attempts by companies to put up paywalls, for example, right? And it has limited gains, at least from what we have seen so far. I mean, Tidal is a great example. Like, Tidal, that music sharing site, they boasted these exclusive content, I think like a Kanye album, but it didn't really work out. Eventually, that Kanye album had to, you know, be streamed onto other platforms as well. Why? Because you need those mass numbers, right?
So yeah.
It's kind of a catch-22.
There's another thing, and I'm not promoting piracy, but there was a time in when you could actually get a whole range of art house movies through your pirate DVD seller. You know, not that I availed myself of those things. I'm not going to admit to any crime on air. But that was true. And in a country where cinemas had no imagination, nobody was going to set up, you know, none of these multi-million dollar cinema complexes were going to set up an art house thing dedicated to alternative films and all that. So where could you get it? There are now things available like Mubi.com and all that allow you to stream these things, because, you know, the platforms are created elsewhere, but because of the wonders of the internet, we can access them there too.
Oh, the good old internet. So again, going back to this website here, this infringing website list, again, a question mark is being posed about how effective this rollout will be, and whether or not, and this is an ongoing discussion within the industry now, right? Whether or not the business models, you know, on their side, whether that has been tweaked, you know, in other words, if you can't beat this piracy thing, how else can we monetize our content? That is a discussion going on in the music industry, certainly movies, you know, TV shows, etc.
Now, thank you for all your comments on the other issues that we brought up this morning, including the one on WhatsApp. But we have one, it's from an anonymous. I don't think that's a surname. That might be a given name. And says, I ignore all forwarded messages. I only read these when I'm on the throne or waiting in queue. How very quaint. Okay.
Mental picture in mind.
Right, yes. Anonymous on the throne. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.